The views expressed on Science for the People are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
This is Science for the People, and I'm Desiree Schell. This week, we'll be digging into some lesser-known aspects of that lovely bundle of tubes, the Internet. A little later on, I'll be talking to Rob von Cronenberg about a concept called the Internet of Things. But let's start out talking about net neutrality. Hello and welcome to Science for the People. I'm here with Dr. Michael Geist, a law professor at the University of Ottawa, where he holds the Canada Research Chair in Internet and E-commerce Law. Dr. Geist is a syndicated columnist on technology law issues, with his regular column appearing in the Toronto Star and the Ottawa Citizen. Dr. Geist is the editor of several copyright books, the editor of a number of monthly technology law publications, and the author of a popular blog on internet and intellectual property law issues. Thanks very much for being here, Michael.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
All right. So you are here to talk to us about net neutrality. So I guess to start off, what is it?
Yeah, no, that's always the first question, and it's always Not quite a challenging question, but one where, depending on who you ask, you get different responses. My view is that at its heart, net neutrality is all about treating content, applications, and other internet traffic in a neutral or equal fashion. So regardless of the kind of content, the applications that are being used, the source of the content itself, it'll be treated by internet providers in a non-discriminatory fashion. It doesn't matter who sent it or what it is, all bits, in a sense, are equal.
So is that, in effect, what we have now?
Sort of.
Right.
Or at least, I think for a time, that's certainly what we had. I suppose it's less and less the case today that that's what we have. I mean, it's certainly the case that there may be some kinds of, some amounts of prioritization by internet providers, so that there are certain at certain times, they may, as part of the way they manage their network, engage in certain kinds of activities. The real concern comes up where they do so for discriminatory purposes or for purposes that give themselves real preferences. That's where you start to see regulators in some places, including in Canada, begin to say there's a real problem.
Well, who wouldn't want a preferenceless internet?
So consumers certainly would want a neutral internet. Internet users, I think, see the advantages of ensuring that whatever they access will be treated equally. But the internet providers themselves often will have incentives to ensure that there isn't a neutral internet. And that's true for a number of reasons. One of the most obvious ones is that many of the largest internet providers, certainly in Canada and also increasingly in the United States, are very large, vertically integrated companies that provide not just access to the internet, but also large broadcast properties. They often have many internet sites and services. And so the incentives to treat their own content in a preferential manner so that it somehow comes faster or serves their users better is sort of an obvious incentive they might have. There are also the prospects of having third-party websites, so sites and services that might not be affiliated directly with the internet provider, but might be willing to pay the internet provider for preferential treatment so that they get a leg up on some of their less well-funded competition. So a lot of it just comes down to dollars at the end of the day, and there may be money to be made for some of the larger providers from a non-neutral internet.
Well, but they do have not profit-based arguments. They say things like that maintaining net neutrality will discourage innovation and investment.
Yeah, well, we haven't really seen much. That's sort of the standard, somewhat pat answer that, mm-hmm. that's given. That if they're if they are forced to treat all content in an equal fashion, they'll stop investing. There's really been no evidence that that's the case. In fact, if we take a look at the sector, it's been a highly profitable one for some time, and the profits that are being generated by the large telecom companies and cable companies that provide internet services well exceed most of the other major areas in the market. market. And one of the reasons that they continue to invest is because it's well worth their money to do so. And they do so even in places where there are net neutrality rules in place. So I don't know that there's a whole lot of evidence out there to suggest that those businesses would stop investing if forced to treat everything equally. In fact, in some places, they're already forced to do so, and they still invest actively. I think the reality is it's a pretty vibrant sector. The problem from a consumer perspective remains a lack of choice. I think some of the net neutrality issues go away to a certain extent if users had lots of choice in terms of who their internet provider might be. And so if someone chose to offer up a non-neutral internet with preferential services, the user could say, I don't like that, and they could easily just switch. But the reality for most internet users who are looking for high-speed broadband services, they typically won't have more than two real choices. You often will have a cable provider, and you'll often have a DSL or telecom provider. And given that both typically seem to operate in much the same fashion, we're not talking about a market when viewed from an individual consumer perspective that's particularly competitive.
Well, what about the idea that that bandwidth availability is going to be an issue, and this will circumvent that? Is that a valid concern?
No, that one's not even close, actually. It's one that was raised a number of years ago, actually, even when Canada was itself conducting hearings on the prospect of net neutrality rules, or what the CRTC, the Canadian regulator, ultimately called internet traffic management policies, ITMPs, protocols, to deal specifically with how internet traffic was being managed. And at the time, the big concern was around issues related to peer-to-peer file sharing and claims that some of that file sharing, particularly those that use the BitTorrent protocol, would hoover up large amounts of bandwidth, and that there was a real concern that we'd, in a sense, not quite run out of bandwidth, but have clogged pipes was the analogy that was often used, and so that you needed to engage in this sort of activity. The reality in the years since is that some of those same providers have actually removed some of the caps and other sorts of limitations that they were putting on, even on those services. So, for example, many of them were engaging in what were often referred to as throttling practices, where they were limiting the amount of bandwidth made available to those applications like BitTorrent, arguing that they would simply suck up as much as was available to them, and that was causing congestion on the network. They don't even try to make that argument anymore, and most of the major providers have stopped those kinds of throttling practices.
Well, aren't broadband service providers saying that this is all just completely hypothetical anyway? That they don't have any plans to block content or to degrade network performance in any way, and so this is a moot point, as it were.
Well, I don't think it's moot because we've got active cases before the CRTC here in Canada. We've got active cases in other countries where it seems pretty far from moot. It seems actually to be quite real world, and it's happening. I mean, we could go back almost 10 years and we could see that there have been sometimes isolated incidents, but incidents where we do have even blocked acts, blocked websites. That's pretty rare, but that has happened. In terms of engaging in practices that might be seen as violating net neutrality principles, or at least granting oneself preferential treatment, those are real world. We're seeing it right now, for example, in the United States, where there is concern about deals that are being struck between Netflix and some of the larger players, and the prospect that some of the larger internet providers are essentially saying, you're using up lots of our bandwidth, Netflix, and unless you pay, we can't guarantee that the service that your end users are going to get is going to meet their expectation. Now, in a truly competitive world, someone who's a big Netflix fan would say, okay, to the ISP, if you offer me crappy Netflix, I'm going to just go somewhere else and switch my service because Netflix is an important service for me as part of my internet access. But those people typically don't have that choice. I mean, there's just not enough providers out there on an individual basis to make some of those kinds of choices. Here in Canada, we've seen complaints against large providers where they've been interfering with some real-time gaming, which actually did result in a finding that, in fact, fact they were interfering with some of the real-time gaming activities and were ordered to stop by the CRTC. More recently, we've got a complaint that deals specifically with the broadcast content that's made available often through wireless services by companies such as Bell, where they treat their own or they treat the broadcast content that comes through one of their services differently from other broadcast content that someone might more generally access on the internet. So far from being sort of a theoretical concern, I actually think we're seeing some real-world issues emerge.
This is Science for the People, and I'm talking about net neutrality with Dr. Michael Geist, the Canada Research Chair in Internet and E-commerce Law. Okay, well then, what are the arguments for net neutrality? The ones that you haven't mentioned, because there are actually more.
Right. Well, as I said, I mean, I think at its heart, I think that it's certainly something that's pro-consumer in the sense that it gives people the full freedom of choice, knowing that whatever they seek to access will be treated in an equal manner. I think it offers up an environment that's far more pro-innovative than the alternative, and raised some of the arguments that come up from time to time from providers saying that somehow they will be less innovative and invest less if there are net neutrality rules. Indeed, I think actually in many instances, the opposite is true. When we take a look at some of the real success stories today online, one of the ways they've become success stories is that they've taken advantage of a neutral internet when it was available to them. And so it didn't matter how big or small you were, if you found an audience, you were willing to pay for the bandwidth to make sure that you could reach that audience, you were in a position to emerge as a player. And, you know, we look at all the myriad of success stories, commercial success stories, cultural success stories, entertainment success stories, and many of them are sort of the proverbial getting started in a garage kind of thing or in the basement. And those players are dependent, I think, upon a neutral internet, because the alternative, one in which there are preferences for either very large players or for players that are linked or associated with the larger internet providers, makes the internet look a lot more like cable television as opposed to the internet. It's one in which the larger players pay to play and they get access and they, in a sense, dominate much of what we see and interact with. And there is less and less space, in a sense, almost a marginalization of so many of the other alternatives that are out there. And I think in many instances, it's those alternatives that over time sometimes become some of the bigger players. And it's also those alternatives that make the online environment such a vibrant place where there is just so much out there to choose from. Moving us from a world once of scarcity to truly one of abundance.
I find a lot of the language around this issue really interesting. You use the term marginalized and terms like data discrimination. It sounds very civil liberties-like. So is this a rights and freedoms issue?
I think it is, and I think that for many who've been involved in this issue, the use of that kind of language is quite intentional. I think that there was a recognition that for many individuals today, that the online environment, both the ability to access information, but also the ability to speak out and interact, is for them sort of their main way, their crucial way of engaging in freedom of speech and freedom of expression. And any attempts really to curtail that in these ways, where you create almost a two-tier environment where those that are privileged based either on the fact that they own the networks or that they've got sufficiently deep pockets that they can take advantage of those larger players at the expense, in a sense, of those that cannot, is really something that ought to be discouraging.
Now, is it possible to give us a brief overview of the history here? I'm thinking specifically how it's played out legally and legislatively around the world.
Can try. And so, I mean, the term itself actually comes from a Canadian, Tim Wu, who's a law professor in the United States. But he was the first to coin the phrase. And, you know, if we were to go back roughly a decade, you know, these issues would pop up from time to time. And you had, for a time, some of the larger providers talking about the prospect truly of trying to monetize these services, saying that somehow they owned the pipes, so to speak, they owned the network. And if other players wanted to use them, they'd have to pay for the privilege. And of course, many said, well, everybody already is paying for that privilege. That's what my monthly bill is for. And of course, those that make content available online also pay to make their content available. So it's not that people aren't paying. In a sense, for some of those larger players, they felt people weren't paying enough. And they were very reluctant, they being the large internet providers, to be seen as what's sometimes described as a dumb pipe, to be just an intermediary with no real opportunity to monetize or profit from the relative value of what was being transported, and in a sense just be paid for what was, for the fact that stuff was being transported, and you pay for it regardless of the relative value of what was taking place. That, I think, sent shivers down the spine, certainly of certainly even some of the larger internet players, who saw that they ultimately, if this were to become a common practice, they would face the prospect of having to pay more, and of course so would consumers, and then so would many other emerging artists, emerging businesses, and others who thought they might not emerge if they were facing this. And so what we began to see was a movement towards developing net neutrality rules. And in a number of places, many people looked at existing rules to try to determine whether or not they might be applied such that the rules would already, existing rules, might deal with these concerns. Some places said, well, we might be close, but perhaps it needs a little bit of tweaking and some updating. In other instances, I think there were some countries that looked at it and said, no, I think we need new rules specifically to deal with these issues. In Canada, the CRTC, our regulator, was faced with a number of complaints that sort of made their way to the commission that had implications for net neutrality. And as I mentioned earlier, all of this ultimately came to the fore through the hearings on ITMP, the Internet Traffic Management Practices, where you had just about every major player, the larger ISPs, many of the cultural groups, some of the broadcasters, and those representing individuals make presentations. There were experts that were retained to address some of the kinds of issues that you were talking about earlier, around what does all of this mean for the network. And the CRTC ultimately struck rules, these ITMPs, that were actually viewed as a pretty good compromise. And so they said that, yes, there is a need for internet providers to be able to manage their networks, sometimes in an appropriate fashion. And so there may be instances where that's appropriate. But at the same time, there are also legitimate concerns about undue preferences, about granting themselves advantages that are seen as unfair, and interfering at times with traffic that's real-time traffic, where the commission had a harder time identifying instances where that might be appropriate. And so we tried to strike that balance, saying that in certain instances it might be appropriate, in other instances not. It opened the door to a complaints-based mechanism. And the system has generally worked fairly well, although we now have some cases before the commission that will, I suppose, put it to the test yet again. In the United States, it's also been a political issue, mm-hmm. one in which was even raised during presidential campaigns and others where candidates were asked about their position on net neutrality. Their regulator, the FCC, Federal Communications Commission, which is the counterpart to the CRTC in Canada, has tried to develop some net neutrality rules. They have faced, I think, stronger opposition from some of the telecom companies. So in Canada, the larger telecom companies may not have loved the CRTC rules, but they were prepared to live with them, if not always abide by them, which is why there's the occasional complaint, but they were generally supportive in the sense that they thought it was a fairly reasonable compromise. In the United States, I don't know that their larger telcos ever thought it was a good compromise, and in fact challenged even the ability for the FCC to do what they were doing, arguing that their interventions was not legal under their governing statute. And in fact, they've been successful in that, which over just the last couple of months, which has really thrown the issue open a little bit in the United States, where there is some doubt as to what the rules are and whether the regulator, at least for the moment, is in a position to do much about it.
Well, I guess what I really want to know is who's winning.
Well, you know, the hard part of answering that question is I'm not really sure what stage in the game we're at.
Right.
So, you know, if we're still early in the game, it might be a draw right now. If it's late, then perhaps things are a bit more dire, because especially in some places like the U.S., there are some real big questions here. So I don't know. I think it's hard to say who's winning or losing. I think in Canada, the pro net neutrality forces have done pretty well. Mm. And they've done pretty well at the commission. They've done very well lately. before the government, which has adopted a very strong pro-consumer approach when it comes to wireless issues generally. And one can well envision a situation whereby if there were clear-cut violations of net neutrality that had big implications from a consumer perspective, the government might make its views known and look for some change. That said, I don't think it's an issue where you score the overtime goal, so to speak, and the game's over. I think what we're seeing is that these issues recycle and recur, often with slight variations. And so every time you think the issue has been solved and we're on steady ground, there we do see innovation. The innovation in the sense of ways to try to circumvent or get around some of its principles. And so you feel a little bit like you're back to square one, having to fight the fight all over again.
Well, for anyone who is listening and still isn't sold on the importance of net neutrality, what would you say to them?
I would say that I guess we can keep talking on the one hand until I get there. I think there's some really good sources where people can obviously make decisions for themselves. I mean, they can certainly take a look at some of the stuff the CRTC has done. In Canada, they can look to the organization Open Media, which has been a leading voice on some of these issues. And in the United States, there are a number of groups, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, EFF, and others that have also been fairly prominent on the net neutrality issue. And there's some pretty accessible materials out there, including some stuff you can find up on YouTube and other video places that for the moment you can access just as easily as any other video, for the most part, that do a pretty good job of explaining some of these issues and at least trying to make the case for why it's important.
Michael, thanks very much for being here.
Oh, sure. Thanks for having me.
And that was Dr. Michael Geist, the Canada Research Chair in Internet and E-Commerce Law. We've linked to him on our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. You're listening to Science for the People, and we'll be right back after these messages with Rob van Kranenburg to talk about the Internet of Things.
Science for the People is a weekly radio show exploring everyday life from a scientific perspective. To find out where Science for the People airs near you, or to listen to past episodes, check out our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. You'll also find links to connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Google+, or to subscribe to the podcast in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Hello, and welcome to Science for the People. I'm Desiree Schell. My guest is Rob van Kranenburg, who works as community manager at the EU project Sociotel. He's co-founder of Brico Labs and the founder of Council. He chairs AC8, Societal Impact and Responsibility in the Context of IoT Applications of the IERC, the European Research Cluster on the Internet of Things. He's also a consultant to IoT China in Shanghai in 2014 and the author of The Internet of Things, a critique of ambient technology and the all-seeing network of RFID. Welcome, Rob.
Very happy to be here.
There are a lot of organizations in your bio that people might not have heard of. Council, the European Research Cluster, IERC. What are those groups?
Especially those two, like Council and the IRC, are interesting. So if you Google for the Internet of Things, you find Council pretty quickly, which is theinternetofthings.au, which is something that I've set up myself as an individual. The other URL for the IRC is the-internetof-things.au. And that's the official European research cluster for the European Commission on basically getting all the European projects on the Internet of Things coordinated. I set up Council in 2009 as I realized that this Internet of Things was going to be very big and needed mediation that was not only coming from the people who understood it in a very long trajectory as ubiquitous computing or pervasive computing or like basically the engineers. But having done that, I also got involved in projects myself, and now I'm sort of also part of the official Internet of Things cluster. And I think this trajectory is something that's only possible the last 21 years with the browser, where we see that individuals and organized groups of individuals can actually gain positions of influence on particular topics because all the data that is out there is basically visible for everyone who is able to somehow make sense of it. I think basically all these groups are very relatively recent, because we tend to think 20 years is a bit of a time frame actually, but of course it's not, and so it's fairly recent, the potential to do this with a relatively small group of people.
Well, you know, since we're clarifying, what does the term the Internet of Things, what does that term mean? Because that's fairly recent as well.
Two ways to think about it. One is to take a very long perspective. And if you take that perspective, you get into Heidegger, into a lot of philosophy of technology, and you basically get down to this moment where, from a particular point in history, some humans picked up a rock and started hitting another rock in order to do something with that rock. And then they turned this into a chisel, and then they turned it into... And then Heidegger saw this moment where the actual tool became something, because of the Industrial Revolution, became something that was no longer really visible in the hand of somebody using that. So it became this technology, this techne, became a little bit sort of disembodied. And he couldn't... So he sort of saw this happening, but he couldn't sort of deal with it. So this last line in Silent Sight is we can't do anything, you can just wait. And I think what we're witnessing, what we're seeing, is that this technology is now sort of taking on a new form. It's becoming embodied again, but through digital means and through computers and through microprocessors and controllers and sensors and actuators. But it's also the moment where we feel, and that's where we all feel so sort of something is happening. We know that we're going to lose out an enormous amount of interaction on what's happening there, because the complexity will be so big and the interface will be so invisible that we will simply going to have to trust an enormous amount of procedures and operations in there that we can no longer make valid, not even with our own eyes anymore, that's long gone, but not even also with all the tooling that we have. So that's basically the long story, which is basically saying that this is happening because something like technology sort of has been happening. And you don't need to go into the transhumanists with this story. You don't need to go very esoteric. It's really, really happening as we speak. And then the second thing with this Internet of Things is that that's a shorter line, sort of starting in the 50s, where people started thinking about cybernetics and about the role of computers in society. And these are people like Stafford Beer. This went into what was called in the 60s and 70s pervasive computing, where IBM did a lot of work, and then into what was called ubiquitous computing, where Xerox PARC and especially Mark Weiser wrote his fantastic text in 1991, The Computer for the 21st Century, where he was basically saying, well, here I am with this desktop, and it has a keyboard and a mouse, and the mouse is from 1964, and in 1964 the computer looked like the Cray 2, and Cray 2 was very big. So he says, for 50 years we made computers smaller, we made them sort of more acceptable for humans, because also in the 80s there were darker people that said that nobody would actually have a computer in their homes, because it would remind people too much of work. So it's all these things. That then went into ambient intelligence. And ambient intelligence was also a term that was sort of very strong European, pushed by Philips. Basically all coming down to the same thing of this environment becoming smart, receptive, and playing back scenarios to you based on your preferences and a lot of data that it would gather from you and in your home and in your car and in all the cities, the services that you would get in your city and from your government and sort of all these open data programs. But also that did not really happen, and it could only happen as Internet of Things. So this is like the fourth iteration of this environment trying to sort of becoming smart, because of the enormous cheapness that we have now of hardware. It's basically costing nothing no more. Microcontrollers and processors and even before the Raspberry Pi, it's going down enormously. We have this huge repositories of open source software where people are start sharing code. Like, and there's no way you can start up on anything now if it's closed, and people are no longer also doing that. So basically, if you want to start up in any kind of application or service, it has to be open source. And this is happening now. You don't even have to say that anymore. It's just like a given. And then, of course, the key issue for this Internet of Things to happen is the enormous cheapness of database storage. If you go to the debates in the 90s, they were all about how database storage was so expensive. And so it was basically totally impossible to think about schemes with like RFID or active sensors or putting cameras in the environment that would then also be digitally handling a lot of data coming in and being able to perform operations basically on the basis of data that was visually coming in, because there was no way to store that data. It was just way too expensive. And then something happened around 2000, and all of a sudden it no longer became an issue. And now we have sort of this cloud, which is this huge wreck of server parks that are sort of basically all around, we have this cheap data analytics, which is basically also costing nothing. So this combination of these enablers of cheap hardware, cheap software, cheap database storage, and cheap analytics is actually making possible what pervasive computing, ubiquitous computing, ambient intelligence is now was trying to do but couldn't do, and it's sort of happening as we speak as Internet of Things.
That is a long explanation. The phrase the Internet of Things is really tough to define for a lot of people.
It is, but it's a repository. It's an umbrella. It was coined by Kevin Ashton in 1999, and it's also quite logical that Kevin then came from logistics and from supply chain and from RFID and AutoID Lab. So the two basic drivers of Internet of Things are the supply chain, logistics, this need to individuate objects, which is basically this RFID territory, where we had this idea that at one point we could turn barcodes, which are from 1974, but don't really identify all objects uniquely because you have a batch of 1,000 or 10,000, into sort of then tracking and tracing products with RFID, making every item, every T-shirt, every bit of piece of soap, every package of coffee, uniquely traceable. This was sort of the framework that he was sort of operating in. So for him, it was quite logical then to see this growing internet, which by then, I would say, only had 6 years of browsers. The browser started 1993 with Mosaic, and so he coined it 6 years after the browser. Not really sort of, it's, I would say it's even sort of, it's happening in between Google and Facebook. So he didn't see sort of this internet with the webs and the mobile. It was all just happening. So for him, this sort of the Internet of Things in this context of supply chain was quite logical. And it, of course, it did tie in, it does tie in perfectly with this second driver of Internet of Things, which is IPv6, which is the protocol that's now being replacing the old IP versions 4 of the internet, because the guys building the infrastructure for the internet in the 80s was working with these big desktops, and they simply couldn't imagine, sort of in their minds, they couldn't see like more than 4 billion of these big chunky things on the planet. So they thought 4 billion unique IP addresses should do it. But they couldn't envisage smartphones, of course, and they simply couldn't see that. And they couldn't envisage microcontrollers and processors on coffee machines, and sure as hell couldn't think about toothbrushes getting a unique IP address. But this is what we think about now. So this IPv6 is enabling basically anything with a little bit of software to be addressable by the internet. So these two drivers make sort of the Internet of Things quite logical.
Basically then, the term the Internet of Things refers to everything being connected somehow by RFID, or we have some other processes now. And actually, let's go back. What is RFID for anyone who doesn't know?
Well, RFID is radio frequency identification, and sort of this goes back to World War II, when the Spitfires had these big active RFID sensors in the coins of their noses, and it was emitting all kinds of signals, were being picked up by their home bases in the UK, and they could pick out the Spitfires from the German planes that were following them and shoot them down. So this sort of friend or foe technology then went into all kind of access control. So basically anybody that's listening now has RFID in their wallets, whether it's in their bank passes or in their passports or in their codes, in their little cards where they check into a hotel, or you go in and check in for work. You open the door for your work, or even sometimes your house. Or a lot of people now have RFID keys to their cars. It's basically that it's a little sensor that's hidden in the door that's emitting a little bit of radio and a little bit of energy that's being picked up by the antenna in the card. And the antenna has sort of then wakes up this little chip that just says, hey, here I am, and sends a number. And this number goes to a very local database, and this database that says, okay, this number can access this car or this building or this room for this amount of time. And so we're all quite familiar with it and the process. Around 1999, they got it under the penny cost. It was Neil Gershenfield for MIT who sort of got that. And It's getting cheaper and cheaper and cheaper, and there's different versions that can be read out from longer ranges. So if you put this in the context of the barcode, if you would have said in 1974 that basically on any item in the world, there would be this sort of label where you would have this barcode that would identify the object and give it some information about it. A lot of people would have said, well, we can't do that. It can't be done. All across the world, you say, and with all these companies then having to give up some amount of data and some amount of control and some amount of agency over their supply chain process, they're not going to do it. Well, they did, because they saw the huge benefits across the whole spectrum and horizontally. So it's not like RFID will sort of be replacing the barcode sort of very soon, but it's all going to happen in this ecology of barcodes, QR codes that you have when you take a plane ticket, and then RFID, then there's active sensors. There's lots of cities putting moisture sensors in them. They're putting noise sensors up. There's an enormous amount of temperature sensors all around. There's parking sensors for the smart parking programs. There's an enormous amount of cameras in throughout the cities. And then we're just talking about the civilian side of it. I'm not talking about the military side of it, which would be a whole different story, because this amount of tracking and tracing, of course, is being used for surveillance of very particular locations. But just sort of in the whole simple area of everyday life, we will see that with RFID, with the coming of near-field communication, NFC, which already is in a lot of phones, will be on your phone, which will enable you to put your phone to a package of coffee in a supermarket and get some information about who made it, where the coffee comes from. If it was made under some good circumstances, you might be able to sort of pay more even and give it directly to the farmer if you want. But of course, it will also mean that once you put your phone to that package of coffee in the supermarket, that all the people in your Facebook network are also seeing that you're putting your phone to a package of coffee in the supermarket. And if there's some friends in your network that are also in the supermarket, and if you're all going to buy this package of coffee, you can get a discount, things like that. So all these things will happen, and as they have happened, because we as humans are basically the third factor in all of this. So this huge need to individuate objects and this huge need to connect objects is being fed and fueled by our need to connect objects and individuate objects and be connected.
Can you explain what the world would look like if we did have a fully functioning Internet of Things? I think that would help people. Can you paint a picture for me?
The ultimate picture of this Internet of Things, sort of the ultimate goal, is to get a total view of any process that is analog in a digital form, in order then to be able to work on that in the virtual realm that is then sort of happening, and then port that back to the analog reality. And this basically means a huge amount of disciplining of, well, basically the 7 billion humans that are now on this planet.
You're listening to Science for the People, and we'll be right back after these messages.
On the next episode of Science for the People, we're looking at the relationship between insects and humans in life and in death. We'll speak to entomologist and essayist Jeffrey Lockwood about his book, The Infested Mind: Why Humans Fear, Loathe, and Love Insects. And we'll talk to entomologist Eric Benbow about the use of insects as a tool for forensic investigation. That's next week on Science for the People, on your local radio station, or online at scienceforthepeople.ca.
Do you get the sense that people are really tired of talking about privacy at all? Like the conversations about the NSA, I feel like they just burnt everyone out. There's, you know, we have a different generation that's grown up, quite honestly, I think, without the expectation of privacy.
I think so too, in a way. Sort of, we have this proposal, and I really like it. It's about sharing moods. This goes like very far, but if you look at what's going on at the moment in terms of health issues, then mental health is becoming more problematic than a lot of physical health issues. Also in terms of money, so there's a business case. In the UK, there's more people at home now with mental issues, with like depression, obsessive compulsive disorder, all these things are on the rise. And it's costing an enormous amount of money every year. 90% of all the people who are in these ranges do not get any treatment, do not see any psychologist at all, because basically all the focus goes to the heavy cases, the people that are really that get so upset or so sick or so ill that they're a threat to themselves or other people, and that's when people start to work, but then it's way too late. So we're thinking, if we combine wearables with all these things and then start sharing moods. And as we talk about with some people who really feel that this is necessary, we get things like to share, say yes, because sharing is validating. Because then you get this idea that it's not just me in my idiosyncratic bubble being sort of like all alone, have to protect my privacy. From what? Sort of from whom? And as I sit there on my own, I sort of lose out on the enormous capacity that sharing a lot of things with my friends and family and other strangers could actually bring me as benefits. So actually I'm beginning to sort of to switch the whole thing around, to become quite positive about the whole thing on all levels. So
then is the Internet of Things sort of a net good depending on who's controlling it? Is that the essential issue?
This I observed that with lots of people who sort of for the first time run into this. So it's like the first is shock, like, and then the second is you want to stop this, and then
stop being tracked. Everything.
No, stop the whole thing. Stop the whole thing. Stop the whole. Just, if you had if I had a red stop button here, sort of like I would push it, right? I would freeze everything and say let's talk about this, because once we got this in place, it will never ever go back, and we cannot go back also. So we have to sort of debate this. But then again, if you look at what's happening at the moment in the world, I mean, it's just a lot of good things going on. Again, this enormous amount of cheap hardware, local production coming back also to the States. People, the 3D printing, sort of the small do-it-yourself bio, and this whole Internet of Things, cheap hardware, software, database storage. People are starting up on basically anything. It's all about sharing. So at this moment, it's like the parking panda is out there in the States, where you sort of open up your space before your house, and then somebody can park there for a while. People are sharing cars. If you would have said people are sharing cars and 5 years ago, everybody would say you're crazy, because your car is like your castle, your home, like this. But this younger generation doesn't care. They care about mobility, and they're sharing cars. They're sharing tools. So now we see Internet of Things type of platforms sort of happening in the neighborhood, where people start sharing their power drills, and sort of you can rent that. Leasing is a very logical business model for the Internet of Things, as you will always have a product that has some connectivity. So if something breaks, you don't know sort of what's happened. So you're basically going to lease the object, like you're going to lease the electric car, because the car has a cost of 40% in the battery. So if that dies, it's also, so you lease it. So we're going towards this leasing and sharing, and this is happening as we speak.
So you're talking about things like Airbnb, where people exactly are willing to sublet their homes and link up with people that are looking for a place to stay. And I'm also thinking like Uber, which
exactly
connects. So that's part of the Internet of Things as well.
Absolutely, absolutely. The Internet of Things basically is fueled by the Internet, and the Internet is fueled by this huge need that we as humans have to share our ideas and knowledge. And we must not forget that in 1451, we had the ability to start printing books in Europe, and the first public libraries are from 1918, which means that power, which is basically at that point was the church, some kings and some industrial tycoons in the making, sort of were able to stall distributing learning tools for over 450 years. I mean, if I had asked in 1600 in Europe or in 1700, can I read a book in my language, I'd be burned. So, I mean, that's quite a step from being in 2014, just opening up your laptop. And you don't need any money, you don't need any, you don't need a lot of money, you don't need a lot of resources, and you don't need a lot of any kind of political or connections or in order to start something online, which we've seen happening now for the past 20 years. And we see it with the Mark Zuckerbergs, of course, and with the Larry Pages and the Googles and all these sort of now sort of seemingly big companies, only 15 to 20 years old, even under that. College, half college dropouts or some students that actually sort of start building then the mental model sort of for this space. And this is happening again. So in that respect, I've sort of come to think about this whole operation. It's an operation that is not hurting like little people. It's not hurting small people. It's not hurting citizens. It's actually an enormous empowerment of anyone who wants to do something with their talents or start sharing. So sharing them, it's never been that easy.
Well, I guess the issue is, yes, we have all these small companies and groups that are really taking advantage of technology to share their skills or share their products, but aren't they just eventually bought up by larger companies? It seems that's the way it goes.
Well, that was sort of the case in sort of this old paradigm of where we come from. But some people are beginning to understand that this Internet of Things is really disruptive. So just picture this moment, this sort of picture for yourself, this full connectivity or full traceability in the system. For example, the new Boeing has 200 monitored items. So it means that 200 items in the new Boeing have their own monitoring system. If I'm somebody who is delivering a service to this one monitoring system, Boeing can no longer hide legacy or any other costs in this whole operation. So you see, the whole thing is that these also the big companies, the Ciscos of this world, with their 1 trillion forecasts. I was invited to Cisco last year in Santa Clara, the World Steering Committee, and I'm part of the World Steering Committee. And I really enjoyed talking to them because there's a lot of expertise and a lot of absolute brilliance out there. But they still seem to think that that sort of the whole operation will be very disruptive on the one hand, but a lot of other things will stay constant, like money. There's no need for money in an Internet of Things environment. When you get to this full traceability, what you will see is a lot of B2B, a lot of business to business that will start swapping things or swapping energy or sort of doing things. There's lots of Bitcoin and Freecoin and what have you coins in that world. It's a totally different system. So there will be an enormous amount of value in the system with very little money. But actually, I shouldn't say that because I still need them to install all the sensors before they actually figure out what they're installing. So basically, what they will install is a kind of situation where the lights will be full on, and the lights will be full on everybody and everything. And this is what we see happening. So if you're dishonest, well, stay dishonest, then people will just say you're dishonest, CEO dishonest. And if you're honest, just go on, continue that, and people will see that, and they will come and buy your product.
I think you're an optimist, very simple, sir.
I'm a realist. I'm a realist. I'm actually not so tuned to. Oh, I'm quite optimist, I guess, but I'm actually quite tuned always to seeing where things can go wrong. But at the moment, I don't see where they can go wrong. Everything's going extremely well.
What about the idea of dependency? That. This really relies on everything being stable and staying the same as you were talking about. But if everything is connected and for whatever reason one part goes down, it does affect the entire network then, correct?
Well, sort of this is why we have to talk about all these things. So if we don't discuss it and if we don't find a way to build this together, we will indeed end up with this situation where we'll have this seamless connectivity. This dream of this seamless connectivity in smart cities and all this stuff running in the background, where indeed, if it fails, it will break and you don't know how to build it, how to rebuild it. So this is exactly what the Japanese are now doing in this conference in China that I advise, the IoT China 2014. Last year, we had an entire afternoon of Japanese researchers that were basically saying that they are going to rethink their smart city policy because of the tsunami, because only like 10 inches of water wiped out billions of yen of worth of infrastructure. Plus, when the tsunami hit, none of the people that were involved, also the engineers on the ground, had no clue where the agency was in the system because it was all hidden and they had no sort of, it was built so beautifully sort of, and, but there was no knobs or bolts or whatever. There was just no way in for them. So they're rethinking that to make it more resilient and also to educate people more into the system itself. If we don't discuss this, then this will be built as this kind of sort of invisible lab, and then the dependency will be huge because we will feel that we, and as we do feel now, I think also culturally, like and psychologically, that things are not sort of happening really well. But sort of we know we can't get out of there, because if we get out of there, the whole thing breaks. It was like the argument of we have to bail out these banks because they're so big and they're so, it's dependency of the system is so big that we have to keep sort of paying these awful people more money, because otherwise if we don't, sort of they'll bring down the whole system. And yes, so we want to get out of there. So we can get out of there because we can build this thing with a very, very good balance between local intelligence, which would mean that we have all kinds of data stream going to neighborhood servers on the level of the neighborhood, there is agency on what sensors are running, what is being collected, and how this data is being used, and what kind of energy management is there. And yes, if people are installing IP46 washing machines, and yes, they have to run them, all the neighborhood then has to wash at 4 o'clock. Well, if you don't, then you simply pay a lot more. Well, all these things could be hugely beneficial for energy management. And but of course, they're a huge attack on personal liberties. But if we can then sort of have debates on a neighborhood level saying, look, we can all make a lot of money because we're going to pay a lot less. But then we can take a lot of energy out of the system if you all wash your clothes at 4 o'clock. It's a bit, it's a bit annoying maybe, but then at least you can talk about it. So it's perfectly possible to build an Internet of Things infrastructure with a huge local agency and generic enablers, so that we also globally run protocols and standards and so on and stuff. Because the alternative is that either people are going to build their own Internet of Things, which we get like hundreds and thousands of intranets of things, plus everybody's going to put all these RFID readers in their homes, in their streets, and in their companies and in their stores. And this is just going to be awful, probably, for the birds who will be flying through even more EMF in the sky. And so it's just going to fry us more. So this is the debate that we need to have. So say, look, there's no way we're going to stop this. And so we're going to build this, and this is going to be built with you, without you. If we build it without you, you will probably end up in quite a tough world from now to 20 years, because the money will no longer go to the cities. The money will no longer go to sewage systems in Montreal or Toronto. The money will go to seamless, smart cities for 10,000 people or for 5,000 people, which is, as we are seeing happening now, 60% of all the building in the United States is gated communities, and this is on the rise. So the money will go to these gated communities, and they will be heavily militarized and sort of zones, basically, and there will be Mad Max in between.
Okay, so you mentioned militarization and gated cities, and that... Is there a way that we can discuss all this that doesn't make us sound vaguely unhinged? Because it seems like this is a very polarizing topic. We have people that are all in already, damn the torpedoes. And then we have people that, they don't want to appear like Luddites, let's say, or technophobic, but there are legitimate issues. So how do we have a dialogue that allows us to keep all the benefits of the Internet of Things without the honestly terrifying parts of this?
But I mean, basically, they're not so terrifying. You have to be realistic. I was invited last year to a conference from the GFF, which is based from the CIA and the Italian intelligence community in Rome. And it was beautiful, and Naval Academy, and it was like 150 people from MI5, MI6, Homeland Security was there, serious organized crime, everybody was there. And it was I was talking on the Internet of Things, and after me, Rick Hudley spoke from the VP, Vice President from Cisco, basically saying exactly the same. We agreed totally on sort of what was sort of going on. Well, in the afternoon, there were breakout sessions, and in one of the breakout sessions, I was walking in, and I couldn't have been there the day before, so I walk in, it's the second day. And it says on the board, the total inability of the state to deal with the digital. So this was what they had thought up on day one. So I said, okay, I'm not going to say anything. I rest my case. So we go back into the room, and it's like the five major threat scenarios that these intelligence professionals are thinking up. Two are about do-it-yourself bio, and one is a military threat. But the other two was about the total disruption and sort of society because of the inability of the state to deal with the digital. So basically, this is not, and I wrote that 10 years ago, and some people before me wrote that 20, 30 years ago. I mean, this is not such a, and it's kind of a no-brainer. But the key issue was for me that that this is a very, very broadly shared idea, that the situation is very, very serious. It's quite drastic. I mean, these states have no more agency. These companies have no more moral ground. So there's a huge void. We see this basically everywhere. We see this translating into people turning away from democracies or turning away from all kinds of forms of organization. Now, I would say this is not necessary, because we can find a balance, and this balance that we can find is exactly in this balance between local intelligence and sort of global intelligence that's going on. So we all know that the internet's facilitating these huge amounts of sharing of knowledge and tools. We also know that every bit of operation that we have on an economic scale is relying on things that go diametrically against that, like copyright patents and sort of all these things. And this is out. This is out of the system. And this Internet of Things will take all of this out of the system. It will show this whole, the bloatedness of this system. It will sort of, it's going to prick the balloon. The balloon will sort of go, so take all this so-called, all this money of all these shareholders of all these companies, which basically doesn't even exist. So it will take everything down to more realistic levels. So this is basically also what I've been doing with friends of mine, have been doing, talking a lot to companies, but they get it. Talking a lot to institutions and to governments and to lots of ministries, and saying, look, we need to work together on this, because we know all this is going to happen. But your inability to deal with this is going to cause it's going to make it so difficult for all these people, all the stakeholders, to still work with you, that you're on a breakdown scenario. So you're going to run a breakdown course. And there's no need for that, because we want to combine the absolute skills of bureaucracy, of mediation, of having this long-term view, combine that with local monitoring and getting a really, really good sense of what is going on the ground. So basically, the whole thing is about taking ego out of the system.
I have to point out, you wrote The Internet of Things, and you seem remarkably more optimistic about where this is going now.
Well, actually, I think the last line of my text is I've got my window open wide, which was a very deliberate moment, because I was also feeling sort of getting, I was talking to lots of students, I was teaching a lot, and also industrial designers. And I was getting this idea that, I mean, if really all we have at this moment is saying that things are so negative and that we these things are changing and the dynamics of it is no good, and that what on earth do I have to say to a younger generation now? What on earth can we say? And they all seem so happy, and it's going so well. So and we should say it's not going well. It's actually, no, you should really worry about this and worry about this. And wait a minute, you may seem a little bit happy now. You may think that you're so connected, and you may think that you share so much, but actually you're not. I mean, should I say that? I feel like I can't say that. So I was also realizing that a lot of these things that that there's a lot of truth in what, of course, the old, what Nietzsche always says. I mean, that you gotta sometimes you gotta really reverse things and but you gotta be able to look them in the eye, sort of to stare in, at the abyss and look into that and take it from there. Well, if we do this honestly at this moment, then who can say that the 18th century was better, or the 19th century was better, or that the Middle Ages was somehow better, or whatever? I would say no. I would say any individual now has such an enormous amount of agency on all these levels. And it's not about succeeding in doing things with that, but at least in trying. I would say this is an enormous time.
Rob, thanks very much for being here.
Glad to be there, and I hope I made some sense.
And we've linked to Rob Van Cronenberg in his book, The Internet of Things, on our website at scienceforthepeople.ca.
Science for the People is recorded in Edmonton, Alberta. The show is produced by Rochelle Saunders. Ryan Bromsgrove is our promotions manager. Our social media manager is Chelsea Butler. K.O. Myers updates our website. Helen Quivillon is our publishing liaison. Ed Haynes is our guest coordinator. We get research help from Josh Witten. The show is edited by K.O. Myers and Ryan Bromsgrove. Our theme song was written and recorded by Fractal Pattern, and its title is Binary Consequence. The show is hosted by Rochelle Saunders, Marie-Claire Shanahan, and me, Desiree Shell.